Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Spirit of Prophecy podcast. Today, I want to reflect a little bit on my interview I had with Pastor Doug Wilson. If you have not seen that, make sure you check it out. We had a very interesting conversation. I enjoyed it very much. One of the things I love about the different guests I have on this program, and especially a lot of the ones who I would disagree with, is often, and these are the best ones, when after it's done, I've got to chew on what I heard for a long time. They give me a lot of things to think about, and it's always challenging whenever I have these guests on. I'm trying to keep the program flowing, and I'm trying to stick to topic and all those different things. But often, man, the wheels are just turning in my head and I'm wanting to go chase all these rabbits and if I'm not careful, I can really get distracted and cause us to go into the weeds. And so whenever I do these programs with people like him, I try to just kind of stick to the plan, the outline and things I had. But then often I'm like, man, I'm going to have to think about this for a while. And there was a lot of good stuff in that program. And one thing that program really did, it got me looking at really the certain outlook on the millennium and on prophecy. And one of the things that I've noticed, and I'm going to be preaching about this on Sunday, is when it comes to Bible prophecy, it is a very positive thing. We often spin it in a very negative way. And I'm going to talk about why people do that. I do believe it's wrong. I believe that Bible prophecy is a very positive thing. The book of Revelation is a very positive, optimistic book. Some of you think it isn't, but I'm going to show you it's because you're looking at it from the wrong angle. You've got the wrong mindset. And if we have the wrong mindset when looking at Bible prophecy, it will cause us to come to some false conclusions. And what I'm going to be preaching on is optimistic premillennialism. And Pastor Wilson in that interview, he mentioned there are optimistic amills and pre-mill people out there. And I'm glad he acknowledged that because I do. I think we can even take a lot of the things that the post-mills often talk about in a very positive way, where the dispensational pre-mills are often very negative and pessimistic about it. And I think we can actually join up with them and say, no, they're actually right about this. They're right in this fact. Now, the conclusion they jump to might be false as based on that truth. Calvinists do that a lot, but on many different things. But I do. I believe you can be premillennial and very optimistic in your eschatology. I believe we should be optimistic. Dispensational premillennialism teaches that in each dispensation, it ends basically in failure and chaos, only for God to have to come in and kind of fix everything. And that's how they view the dispensation we're in right now. And I'm going to show you, the scripture shows us succeeding in this dispensation, for lack of a better term. We are going to win. And not just because we are just laying there in defeat and just it's all over. And then Jesus shows up and then we win. We win. And then Jesus returns. See, and the reason that blows some of your minds is because you have the wrong idea of what winning looks like. You have the wrong idea of what success looks like. I'm going to show you, when it comes to the Great Commission, we will succeed. The problem for some of you is when you hear that, you define success in a way that the Bible does not. And so the reality is we are going to succeed. Success just might not look like you think it's going to look like. And so but because we're going to succeed, we absolutely should have an optimistic outlook. And the Bible is optimistic. We read our pessimism into scriptures. And I'm going to show how we do that. But that's one thing I really got from that conversation. I am still premillennial by a lot, but I am much more optimistic than your dispensational premillennial. And I believe the pessimism that comes from the dispensational premillennial world is one of the things that's leading people to amillennialism and postmillennialism, because that people aren't seeing that negative outlook in the scriptures. You know why? Because it's not there. And so the only people they're hearing talking in a positive way when it comes to the gospel and the Great Commission and all these things is the amills and the postmills, mainly the postmills. And so I think we need to do better at showing what success is and being optimistic about it, so we don't lose more people to the on-mills and the post-mills. So I did want to read a couple of YouTube comments. I'm not calling this a damage control episode because there has not been enough controversy for this to be worthy of damage control. It's been a little bit of negative feedback, but mostly positive. I got a lot of really good feedback, even from people who disagree with Doug Wilson. Okay. Before I scheduled this interview, it was scheduled like 2 months ago. Before I scheduled this interview, I knew very little about Doug Wilson. I saw him several months ago when he was on Tucker Carlson, was very intrigued, enjoyed that conversation a lot. But you know, he did seem like he was a pretty big name. I mean, he's on Tucker Carlson. He's not going to come on my program. So I didn't even really think about asking him. But then I had several people who, even before that, had said I should have him on. And after that, I had many people tell me, hey, you need to have Doug Wilson. You need to have Doug Wilson. And I'm like, I don't think he's probably too big for me to get on the program. But I was like, oh, I'm going to try. So I reached out. Sure enough, he said he would. So I've been excited about it. Now, since then, I started telling people, yeah, I've got Doug Wilson coming on the program. Oh, do you know this about him? And everybody started telling me all these horrible things about him. I have not fact checked any of these things just because I typically don't pay much attention to Baptists and what they say about other people. They might be right. I don't know. But I think I knew less about Doug Wilson than just about everybody else. Even my wife knew who he was. I told her, I was like, hey, I scheduled a guy to come on. He's a pretty big name. He was on Tucker Carlson, Doug Wilson. And she was like, I know who he is. And I guess she had one of their books or something. And everybody knew him but me. And then I had, and so I had all these warnings. And I'm like, you know what? I am just going to stick to the subject we had talked about having. And I will make my judgments based on our interaction. And so, folks, please do not send me articles, video clips about him. I am not a Doug Wilson follower. I am not looking to be a Doug Wilson follower. I just wanted to have a conversation with him that would be interesting. And we succeeded. Mission accomplished. And I will say, based on my conversation I had with him, I liked most of what he had to say. I enjoyed it. And so somebody who has a big name like him, people say a lot of false things, and I just don't have time to go fact check everything. Okay. He is not going to be a big part of my life. And so I'm not going to fact check all these things. I really don't care. But yeah, so let me show you a couple comments that I got. These are pretty funny. We got one from Chuck Landreth, who, has a little bit of a reputation for being a railer and stuff, but it says, I know you're not afraid to entertain heretics. What I don't understand is why you're so proud of it. Attack good soul-winning churches, heap unto yourself railers and weirdos, and promote known heretics. But bless Chuck's heart. But he has, he's quite the Kool-Aid drinker. But let me just explain a couple things about that, because he is very upset because of my criticism of the new IFB. Here's the massive difference between a Doug Wilson or pretty much anybody else on the planet and the new IFB. Okay. Now, Doug Wilson, I don't know what he knows about me. But at the same time, I'm just going to guess that if Doug Wilson found out I was not a Calvinist, which he probably already knows, if he were to hear me trash Calvinism, he probably wouldn't hate my guts and be super insecure about it, nor would he perceive it as an attack on him. Okay. If he hears me out there debunking postmillennialism, he's probably not going to take it that personal and throw a great big hissy fit. We are different on those things. And so we are able to have conversations. Okay. In the new IFB, you can't do that. That is one thing I found out when I got involved in the new IFB. I knew I was different than them in a lot of ways. In fact, if you go back and watch the first conversation I had with Pastor Anderson, that was public, we talked about a lot of those things. And he said, fine, no big deal. As long as you're King James, as long as you're this, as long as you're that, everything's great. Found out that's not true. Not even close. Because once you gain any influence in that area, if you do, if you sway from whatever the narrative is in any way, you are perceived as an enemy. It is perceived as attacking. And so, yes, am I different than the new IFB on some? Yeah, I'm very different on them. It, you know, I agree with them on eschatology and a lot of other things. But when it comes to Christianity and behavior and, you know, how you live life, I'm very different from them. And understand, I have showed them the same respect on this program. I had Pastor Berzins before many sins had been revealed in the new IFB. I had him on the program talking about the positive impact they had on eschatology. Even though I was like, I'm not new IFB, but at the same time, doesn't mean I can't respect certain things about him. I can't appreciate certain things about him. Because notice in this comment too, you know, he talks about me attacking good soul winning churches. Have I ever attacked their soul winning? No, I've always commended them for their soul winning. And so, yeah, so the thing is, that's an area where we are in agreement. There's a lot of areas where we are in agreement, but there are areas where we are in disagreement. And because of that, there is major hostility. And again, you know, I am very much against, you know, some of the stuff that they teach. Not going to go into all those things. But these people just take it so personal. But yeah, he makes it sound like I'm attacking soul winning. No, I'm attacking bad teaching. I attack bad teaching on the family, just like I attack Calvinism. But me attacking Calvinism doesn't necessarily have to be an attack on Doug Wilson. I could, I guess, if I wanted to. And say, yeah, this is what Doug Wilson teaches. This is why I think he's wrong on Calvinism. Here's how he portrays Calvinism. This is where I think it's wrong. And, you know, but at the same time, in the new IFB, you ever challenge them on anything, they try to find a way to reprobate you, cancel you, all that kind of stuff. And it is just, you know, it's ridiculous. And so, unfortunately, you know, the new IFB is very secluded and very alone because they do not allow for any type of disagreement. Most people are not like that. And a lot of that's based on insecurity, you know, and because notice this other comment too. I got to show you this comment. This is pretty funny. This comes from a place of insecurity. Many Baptists have this attitude, but it said it's only a matter of time before men like Brother Tommy move to a post-millennial or optimistic amillennial position. An open mind and an open Bible always tend in that direction. Not necessarily. I personally think me hearing somebody out, me accurately representing somebody's position is not me, you know, basically on the slippery slope to postmillennialism. I do not believe there is any benefit ever to any position in misrepresenting the other position. It is never productive to strawman another position. And I have been accused of being a preterist. I've been accused of being a Satan's little season guy. I've been accused of being all kinds of things just for accurately representing them. Because often with people on our side, when they start trashing these other positions, I'll be like, hang on a second, that's not true. Oh, what are you doing defending the preterist? I'm not defending the preterist, but you misrepresenting them is going to make us look bad and dishonest. It's not beneficial. And so the thing is, typically Baptists, whenever they talk about somebody else's positions, they do. They always use extremes. Sometimes they just lie. They misrepresent. Where me, I will often get up and say, you know, this is their position and I will use their text. I will accurately represent it. And I've even had them on their end. There was a preterist one time watching one of my things and I started describing it. And it's like, I think Brother Tommy's a preterist, full preterist. It's like, no, I'm not. Just because I understand your position and just because I am accurately representing it does not mean I agree with it. I don't agree with it. I don't agree with Satan's little season. I don't agree with these things. And so, but I do accurately represent them and understand too, you know, a lot of the people who tried to tell me that they told me so about the new IFB, I've told them, you didn't tell me so. You told me 100 negative things and most of them were wrong. So why would I just go along with what you're saying about that, which is right? You hurt your credit. You had already hurt your own credibility with me. And therefore, yeah, I didn't listen. And sure, I'll take some responsibility there, but you know, you were a bad witness because you said so many things wrong. So I don't believe I am on any slippery slope to postmillennialism. No, I think me looking into these things, hearing them out, you know, it's actually helping me strengthen these things. Cause I've been saying this for a long time. I think there's a lot of dumb stuff preached in the name of premillennialism. That is a fact. And if we're going to keep preaching dumb stuff in the name of premillennialism, we can't be surprised if people are dumping it and going to more of an amill or postmill position. So, you know, let's not do that. You know, if I get up and I butcher the scriptures trying to preach once saved, always saved, doesn't mean once saved, always saved is false. But if that person who's on the fence is listening to me and they hear me just butchering the scriptures, the conclusion they might come to is once saved, always saved is false. It's like, no, but maybe, you know, once saved, always saved is true, but maybe I'm just a bad teacher. And so premillennialism, I do believe is true, but that doesn't mean there's a lot of bad teachers and bad teaching in the name of premillennialism. I am calling on the premillennialists to, hey, let's clean up our act. Let's do a better job. And one area where a lot of premillennialists are wrong is in their pessimistic outlook on things and representation of certain scriptures. It's causing us to get the wrong idea about certain things. It's causing us to come to some wrong conclusions. And I think we need to fix that. And I'm looking forward this Sunday to preaching a sermon on optimistic premillennialism. I am going to show you the Bible has an optimistic outlook on things. We are going to win. And we're not just going to get some moral victory. Yeah, we're going to get defeated, but we're really the winners. No, we're going to win. Okay? But that win is going to look like what the Bible describes, not what you think winning looks like in your head. And that's why people go with a more pessimistic view of things, because they don't really like what the Bible describes as the outcome of things. And so you need to get your thinking in line with the Bible. And so it is. It's very positive. But I did want to bring up some points, and I want to try to briefly talk about some of these things about the interview, just that I thought were interesting, because it got me thinking about a lot of things. And those are the kind of conversations I want to have. I want people that are going to get me thinking. And so, but when it comes to Pastor Wilson, again, I get it. He's a Presbyterian. Okay? He's not a Lesbyterian. I love that line. And I think I know what he means by that. It means he's probably more of an old school conservative Presbyterian. A lot of times when we think of Presbyterians and the Methodists and all these, you know, we think of like the United Methodists, the Rainbow People. And obviously, when it comes to even Baptists, they're going liberal. It's going downhill. There's a Baptist church not far from us that has a woman pastor, a Baptist church, woman pastor. So, you know, again, you know, obviously a Baptist church has a woman pastor. Baptists are apostatizing. Well, not all of them. Okay? Now, Presbyterians, I don't even know what their distinctives are. He's probably the first one I've ever even talked to that I know of. So, but again, I'm glad he's not a Lesbyterian, but I have been told he's a Calvinist. I understand that. I've had other Calvinists on the program. Again, your rule that nobody can talk to Calvinists, I don't know. I have not banned them from this program. Sometimes I learn things from Calvinists. And one thing no Calvinist has ever been able to get me to do, though, is move closer to Calvinism. But that doesn't mean I haven't learned other things from them. And as somebody, too, who does not like Calvinism and wants to debunk Calvinism, to me, understanding their position better will help me know how to debunk it better. I don't want people to be Calvinists, but I will not keep people from Calvinism by railing on them, by misrepresenting them, by strawmanning them. So if I pick their brain a little bit, and I do it in a public way, and I do it in an honest way, I don't believe that hurts my cause. I believe that will help in my mission to rid the world, or at least the Baptist world, of Calvinism. I would love to do that one of these days. And, you know, and I wonder if Doug Wilson thinks I'm attacking him right now. I've never heard him, what he teaches on Calvinism, but no, I think he's well aware. There's a lot of people out there that don't like Calvinism. and he doesn't make it all about himself. Because there are some people that have taken certain doctrine and they've made that doctrine about the person rather than the doctrine. And so it's a fact in some places, if an attack on like the reprobate doctrine or something like that would be perceived as an attack on an individual. And a lot of times it would be too, because we are very people focused, and it is so much easier to attack a messenger than it is the message, especially if that message is true. We're going to want to go after the messenger every time. And so if I want to go after Calvinism, I am going to attempt to destroy Calvinism, not necessarily Doug Wilson, because to me, that's lazy and that's too easy. And I've learned there's all kinds of things being said about him on the internet. And so if I'm too pathetic and too lazy and too ignorant to debunk what he teaches, I could just echo negative talking points about him as a distraction. But folks, those of you out there that you want to defeat Calvinism in that way, go right ahead. Some of us want to actually get to the bottom of the issues and actually change people's minds in an honest way. So allow me to do that. You all keep doing your thing. But I'm going to do my thing. So, we talked briefly about just the pessimism versus the optimism. And I loved his softball team analogy that we are, you're going to have a very different outlook and attitude when you're playing a game, believing you can win and believing that you're going to win, than just playing knowing you're going to lose. And that's kind of the attitude. Because we're just hanging on, the apostasy is coming, the falling away, things are going to wax worse and worse. I'm just going to try to be faithful. I'm just going to try to hang on. Yeah, our country's going to pot, but that's the signs of the time. No. Hey, we can win this thing. We're going to win this thing. Stop giving up. When you hear about an apostasy, when you hear about a church closing, don't just be like, oh, that's just, Jesus must be about to come back. No, that is not the attitude we should have. We should have more of an attitude when we see positive things happening, that we're getting closer to the coming of Christ. And you don't have to be a post-millennialist to do that. You don't. I'm going to show that on Sunday in my optimistic premillennialism message. And so I do. Let's play this game like we think we can win, like we believe we're going to win, like we know we can win. Because guess what? Overall, we're going to. I might flop out. I might fail. But overall, we as God's people, the Great Commission will succeed. The good work that was performed in the disciples and even in the church at Philippi is still being performed to the day of Jesus Christ. I know I just blew your mind with how I interpreted that passage, but I'm right. He which hath begun a good work in you will perform it until the day of Jesus Christ. The work that the Philippian church was doing is still continuing on, and we are still reaping the benefits of it to this day. And we'll continue to reap the benefits of it. What they started back then, folks, is still going today. It has not been stopped. It will not be stopped. Some of us individuals will fall along the way, and we will fail. But that work that was started back then, it is going to succeed. It is going to do exactly what God wanted it to accomplish. So I like that. That's the attitude we need to have. We are going to win, and not just a moral victory. No, we're going to win. Okay, we will succeed. And so just stop getting the wrong idea about what success looks like. So I do. I think when it comes to their outlook, as far as being optimistic, the post-mills and the optimistic amills are right, and the dispensationalist premillennialists are wrong. And so I asked them about the difference between post-mill and amill. And let me just say, I still don't fully understand where the big disagreements are on that. You say, you just don't understand enough. Maybe, but I will say this. He did say in that discussion that he became post-mill. One of the things that helped him become post-mill was a book that was actually written by an amillennialist. So, the thing is, if an amillennialist writes a book and it makes you become post-mill, it just shows how close those things are. So one thing I would be interested in, if anybody knows of any good examples of it, I'd like to watch a debate between an amillennialist and a post-millennials, just to see where the real differences are, because they look a lot alike to me. But I like what he said too about interpreting your eschatology by fact checking it with the newspapers. And we've talked on this program before about newspaper theologians. And guess what? We all do that, especially the dispensationalists. I mean, you go to a pre-trib prophecy conference, they will talk more about what's going on in Israel today, what's been on the news in the last several months, than they will what's in the Bible. You are much more likely to hear them talk about October 7th than they are 70 AD. I guarantee it, because they are newspaper theologians. And just understand, if they're right in their interpretation, okay, I think if the newspaper theologians are right in their interpretation, those of us, myself included, who believe that the mark of the beast is a microchip implanted in the hand, okay, let's just be honest. It's the best time of you going away from that position. No, I'm just being honest about it, okay? Can I just be honest for a minute, even if it maybe makes our side look bad? If we are right that the mark of the beast is a microchip they put in our hand, did you know that we believe that Revelation was written in a way and with a message that only we could understand in the 21st century, and that the people it was written to could not understand? And who was it written to? Was it written to us, or was it written to the seven churches of Asia Minor in the first century? Have you ever thought about that? So here's the thing. This is something else he said that's interesting. Okay. Again, just because I bring up a good point that they might have, that maybe we ought to take another look at this, does not mean I'm coming around to their position. This is me maybe helping us clarify ours better, or even reveal flaws in our position. But he said in there, let's see. He said, he mentioned, what is your grid or metric or key for interpreting eschatology? He said, I lost the spot where I have that. Yeah. So he mentioned, is it the newspaper, which is the futurist? If we're interpreting mark of the beast as microchip in the hand, understand we are fact checking the scriptures with the newspaper. Or the news media, or whatever, however you want to put today, the internet. Okay, that's what we're doing. That is our interpretation. We are applying Bible meaning to our modern day situation. Okay, that doesn't mean it's wrong, but that's what we're doing. Let's just be honest about that. That's what futurists do. Now, he called himself a preterist. Now, he's not a full preterist. He believes Jesus is coming back. He believes in a resurrection. Okay, so don't try to attach all of that, what we would consider heresies and our heresies, with what he believes, just because he's a preterist. Now, he views a lot more of Revelation as being fulfilled than we do. A lot more. In fact, most of it. He for sure is a partial preterist. But he said, I keep losing that spot. So his key metric or grid for interpreting the eschatology in the New Testament is the Old Testament. And that is what preterists attempt to do. I don't believe they always do it right. I have heard other preterists, give their interpretation of prophecy, and they, try to base it on Old Testament, and it doesn't make any sense at all. In fact, it's just dumb in many cases. But that's what they are attempting to do. They are looking at scripture that was given in the first century that is apocalyptic, that is symbolic in many cases. And they're saying, what is the proper way to view this? Let's go back to the Old Testament and see if we can find something in there that will help us know exactly how to interpret this. That's what they are attempting to do. Are they doing it right? I don't know. Probably not. Maybe. Here's what I'm saying about futures. We're not even trying to do that. And I forgot that he gave an example of that, where he showed several, he talked about the decreation language is how they refer to it in the preterist world, of like Revelation 6, and the sun, with the sun being darkened and moon turned to blood, and the sixth seal. And they do, they make that a lot more symbolic than we do. But if you'll notice, what he did is he gave a very symbolic interpretation, but then he pulled his symbolism from other places in the Old Testament that use similar language. And you know, it was one of those things. Okay. Yeah. You got to think about that. Chew on it a little bit. We don't even try to do that. No, we look at what the Bible says in Revelation. And then we're like, all right, how can I make that fit? Because we know we're in the last times. I heard a preacher say that. And last times now means all the events right before Daniel's 70th week and the rapture. Even though in 1 John, it says we're in the last times. But we've redefined that. There's so many things we've just redefined, and we've redefined them in a wrong way. And so we're in our minds, Jesus is about to come back. Therefore, these scriptures must be interpreted this way. But wait a minute. What if we still have a few hundred years left? So, and do you understand your interpretation is a new interpretation? And people like Doug Wilson, and I've listened to him before, they do. I don't know if I always agree with them. These are deep subjects, but they do. They at least try to find a precedent from the Old Testament to help them understand how to interpret the book of Revelation. And yeah, when you're in Revelation 9 and talking about Apache helicopters and things like that, you are not interpreting the Bible literally. And even on the sixth seal, you're not interpreting it literally. I don't. Not completely. I do believe it's a cosmic event. I do believe, but I believe it's describing an appearance in the sky. I don't believe the moon's literally going to become blood. I heard a Ruckmanite say one time that it's literally going to become blood, and blood is going to fall to the earth. And that's probably how the blood is going to flow to the horses' bridles in Revelation 19. Yeah. Yeah. That's more literal than me, but that's also stupid. And understand the stars falling from heaven. I don't believe that's literal. I believe that's just the appearance, because in Revelation 8 at the fourth trumpet, a third part of the sun is smitten, and a third part of the moon, and a third part of the stars. How can that be if they all went away? It was because they didn't go away, is in the sense of moving from their spot, but something happened in our sky that changed their appearance. And I do believe that's going to happen. That is my position on that. They have more of a symbolic of it representing Israel. And it's interesting. And I even think to a certain extent there could be some truth to that, but that still doesn't mean there is not a more literal event coming in the future. But even though I say I interpret that literally, there's a lot of people who interpret it a lot more literal than I do, and it doesn't make any sense. So, you know, this whole I interpret the book of Revelation literally, no, you don't. No, you absolutely do not. We all symbolize many things in Revelation. It's proving your symbolism. Most of you, your proofs are based on what lines up with today's events more. Guys like Doug Wilson, they try to use their proofs from the Old Testament. Doesn't mean they're doing it right, but that's interesting. That's interesting. Using the Old Testament as the key rather than the newspaper, that just seems a little bit better to me. But anyway, that's, you know, that's a whole nother subject for another day. And so one thing I completely disagreed with him on, and understand, he did not give his proofs. He did not go into detail explaining why he believes this. I don't fully know why he believes this. I've not heard his teaching on it. He only referenced Romans 11, but his belief about Israel's future. The idea that a revival in Israel is going to happen, that prophecy demands it, or that it could be a sign that Jesus is about to come back. I completely disagree with that. And I'd be interested in hearing his teaching on that. So understand, I'm not here to debunk what he teaches on that, because I don't know how he teaches it. I do know how dispensationalists teach it, and I completely disagree with them. And the fact that he referenced Romans 11 does not intrigue me more that he could be right, because I, you know, Revelation 11, I do not believe is describing a future revival for Israel at all. It sounds like, based on, you know, how he's applying that, he interprets that a lot like the dispensationalists do. And forgive me, because I've not heard his teaching on Calvinism. I've not heard, this is not an attack on Doug Wilson, but every Calvinist I've ever heard preach on Revelation, or not Revelation 9, Romans chapter 9, has done it wrong. To me, if I was going to be a Calvinist, I wouldn't touch Romans 9 with a 10-foot pole. It does not teach what they say it teaches. It doesn't. So if you're getting Romans 9 wrong and Romans 10 wrong, you might get Romans 11 wrong too. And Calvinists for sure have the wrong outlook on Romans 9. So again, how he's getting to that future revival with Romans 11, I don't know how he does it. But folks, I have had all kinds of dispensationalists try to convince me of a future revival for Israel. I don't believe it. I don't see it. And if he were to go to the Old Testament, like a lot of them do, my answer to him would be fulfilled. A lot of the passages that people use as proof text for a future revival in Israel was fulfilled in the first century. And dispensationalists, it's like they read the book of Acts, all of a sudden, chapter 2, new dispensation, it's the church. Wait a minute, all that happened at the temple, that was all Jews where that's taking place. That was Israel. That was the revival in Israel. And just because, as a whole, the majority did not go along with it, did not change the fact that many did. A multitude did believe. A multitude did have a revival. And they are the ones who evangelize the world. Everybody's always talking about these Jewish evangelists that are going to evangelize the world in the book of Revelation. And it's like, what about the Jewish evangelists in the first century? Folks, it was all Jews that evangelized the world and started this work that we are a part of today. What we are a part of today was started by Jews, but Jewish believers on Christ, those who are under the disciples that were a part of what they would call the New Testament church. And so understand, in 70 AD, the remnant that of people who rejected Christ, they were cut off. They were destroyed. They lost their land. They lost the temple. The old covenant, it waxed old and it vanished away. It's gone. But the ones who followed the prophet like Moses, the one who were gathered to Shiloh when he came, they did a work that is continuing to this day. The great Jewish revival and the great Jewish evangelism, it already happened, folks, and we're still reaping the benefits of it. But what happened later, you've got another group who come along, and in 1948, they declare themselves Israel. They declare themselves the people of God, even though they have no legal connection, and biology is not a connection. First off, they don't even have to prove their biology, but even if they did, scripturally, that's not a connection. That does not qualify them. And so to go and to take this group of people that has risen up to great power through this Zionist agenda and to demand prophecy teach a revival for them and to say that that's based on scripture, it's just not there, folks. It is not there. And I know how the dispensationalists teach it, and they are 100,000% wrong. But when it comes to guys like Doug Wilson, I don't know how he teaches it, but that really kind of surprised me that he has that belief. And if he ever wants to talk to me about this or do a follow-up conversation, I'd be more than glad to do that. I do not hate him for those beliefs. I was just surprised by that. I didn't expect that. It's, because again, too, he's not a Zionist. And that's one of the things I saw on Tucker Carlson, and that's good. But a lot of the goofy interpretation I hear about Israel and Israel's future, I typically am hearing it from Zionists. And again, maybe that's bad teaching. Again, a lot of premillennialists teach premillennialism wrong. Doesn't mean premillennialism's wrong. A lot of Zionists preach a future revival for Israel in a way that's wrong. Doesn't mean there's not a future revival for Israel. Okay. So again, maybe I'm getting turned away from a truth because of really bad teaching from Zionists. Maybe that's possible. But I would be interesting if somebody from the post-mill camp, I would be interested in hearing their proofs of a future revival. In fact, he said in one of their prophecy conferences, that's probably one of the subjects they would talk about, is the future conversion of Israel. So if anybody knows of any lectures, sermons, videos on that, I would be interested in hearing that, because I have I've looked at the scripture every way I can, and I do not see a future, the Bible in any way demanding a revival for the current state of Israel. I can see in the Bible a prophecies about a revival and a great evangelism from the Jews, but I have this book in my Bible called the Book of Acts that shows this event that they are, that the Bible prophesies of. And so it's just like, why are we still acting like this is still to come? So, but that was probably one of the things that really surprised me the most about it. But, I will say though, dude, his view on Israel is still much closer to the truth than the dispensationalists. Let's see. So another thing too, he brought up, I'm in the wrong spot here. So Christian nationalism. Yeah. We talked about that a little bit, and a lot of people, they hate that term Christian nationalism, and a lot of people love it. Some of the people that love it are crazy. But here's the thing about this is my thing when it comes to Christian nationalism. It depends on your definition. And even a lot of definitions I've heard people give, they're kind of vague. And so whenever we start, I understand people's fear and concern when they hear some of that talk. And he brought that up, he brought up the red dresses and all that kind of stuff. He brought up manifest destiny and all those things. And I don't have time to talk about what all those are, but understand that, when it comes to there's a lot of things I love hearing when people talk about Christian nationalism. When people talk against Christian nationalism, there's a lot of things that they say, say against it that I'm like, yeah, I would agree. That's terrible. Okay. The question is, do the people who believe in Christian nationalism and promote Christian nationalism agree with those things? I don't know for sure. Okay. I definitely have not listened to enough of Doug Wilson's teaching on this to know what he thinks about everything. Here's what I will say. Based on what he said in the interview with me, I don't have a big problem with what he said. Now, you might be able to take somebody and say, well, this is what he means by that. He wants to do this. Okay, well, we could talk about that, but is that even true? So there's a lot of things that people can say that in themselves are vague, and therefore it's hard to know whether you agree with them or not. I do know that Christian nationalism has kind of become this boogeyman from people who just hate everything about Christianity and do not want it influencing politics at all. And I think Christianity should be influencing politics. And I agree with him that I do. I think it would be a great thing if our nation, we legislated against things that are offensive to a holy God. That's okay to do that kind of thing. As a people who believe God is real and who believe he is in authority and who want his blessing and don't want his cursing, we believe in all of those things. When we look at the Bible and we see how offended God is by murder and the shedding of innocent blood, we ought to do everything we can to stop that. When we see how God feels about stealing and about fornication and adultery and sexual sins and homosexuality, for sure, we should be doing something about that as a government. And God has given government of power and authority to deal with those things. And let's do it. Let's do it. And unless you are just some immoral pagan heathen or something like that, you shouldn't have a problem with that. And there's plenty of countries you can move to where you can be involved in all your debauchery and child sacrifice and things like that. But you know what? I think it's good if governments ban those things. I don't think child sacrifice should be legal. And did you know it is illegal in much of the world today? You know why? Because a lot of our world has gotten better. And that was one of the things too that probably blew a lot of people's minds. Because again, when we think about the world getting better, we're thinking about the political situation in our world right now. But I like how he said that. We don't look at it in metrics of just days, months, years, or even decades, but more centuries. And the reality is, I would rather be living today, in this day, than any other day before. You know why? Because we are advancing. Okay. Again, some of you think advancing means a world without tares. But go look at the parable of the mustard seed that grows and fills the earth. But in that same passage, I'm going to be talking about this Sunday, we have the parable of the wheat and tares. The wheat and tares are going to grow together. But folks, the fact that we have wheat all over the world, you know what that is? That's success. That's a sign that we are winning. The fact that we have places all over the world where it is legal to be a Christian, where Christianity is thriving, you know what that is? That's a sign of the gospel succeeding. And we have that today. Yeah, there's a lot of places where it's not at, for sure. But you know, we also believe in our eschatology, in futurists, God's going to judge the nations. There's going to be a separating of sheep and goats. There's going to be a separating of the wheat and the tares. So I don't know where all postmillennialists go. We didn't go real deep into this, but if you're just going to have this attitude, well, you know, this optimistic postmillennial view, they basically think the whole world's going to get saved. Well, I don't think that's what they think, but I will say for me as an optimistic premillennialist, I don't think that either, but I do believe that we have Christianity all over the world today. And there are some places where it's still really dark. And you know what? We should be like, we got to figure out how to get in there. You know why? Because we're going to win. These dark places in the world, we ought to be sending missionaries there. We ought to be taking mission trips there. We ought to be doing things to reach people there. We ought to thank God for the internet and that we can maybe use that to reach some people in there. And we ought to stand against all the censorship and things that are trying to censor the truth in these places, because we want the gospel to get to these places. If we can get the light of the gospel there, it will change things for the better. And while they'll still have problems in those countries, while every country will always have tares, you know what? We'll start seeing wheat in these places. And there are many nations today with very wicked governments, like America, that are full of Christians, that have Christians all over the place. You know why? Because the world is getting better. There was a time when you couldn't find that. And I would rather be poor today than rich, you know, 200 or 300 years ago. There are many places in our world where it is safe, where we do have prosperity and things are good. There are so many wonderful things about this world we're living in. Yeah, there's some negative. And the pessimistic premillennialists, they focus on all that negative all the time. You know, and then those of us, you know, who have been in the past somewhat pessimistic, we look at those postmillennials, oh, they must all be compromisers. You know, the only way the world's going to get better is if we just compromise and we just accept all these false things. Not necessarily. Again, it depends on the metrics that you're looking at. And yeah, do we have some setbacks locally? I mean, we've had some big setbacks in this nation for sure. You know, but at the same time, while things might be going backwards here in other parts of the world, you know, they're seeing great revivals. I mean, they're seeing thousands and thousands of people saved all the time in places like the Philippines and Mexico and many other places. Just because, you know, and American Christians, we just think America is the whole world. We think it's the center of Bible prophecy. And it's just not. It really isn't. But I asked them specifically about this, you know, is it possible to have a postmillennial view and conquer the world for Christ without shedding blood? And I would have to read into what he said to be too critical about what he said, but it doesn't sound like he wants to go killing heretics and killing everybody that doesn't believe like we do. So I really can't be too critical about what he said. I think I agreed for the most part, but I didn't get a whole lot from his answer about what we are missing as premillennialists. And I understand, you know, he was trying to give a very short answer to a very complicated question. And I got enough to understand that in order, you know, for me to fully process what he said, you know, I think what he was doing on there and what he did do is we all need to check our metrics for our interpretation of the book of Revelation. And the postmillennialists, they have a very different outlook. They do believe it was written before 70 AD. That will change how you look at many things. They do have more of a preterist mentality that this is describing events in the first century until you get to chapter 21 and 22. And that is very different than how we view things. And so it's not a matter of proving how to interpret Revelation 20. It's about proving how you look at the entire book of Revelation. And we are very different in that outlook in a lot of ways. And so, you know, I'm not acting like he couldn't debunk premillennialists. You know, he tried to give a very short answer to something that was very complicated. And so, you know, at the end of the day, I say all that to say that I've not been moved from my premillennialism. I have been challenged in the fact that we should approach it and teach it with a more optimistic view, because that is more biblical. And I do think that our pessimistic outlook is one of the biggest turnoffs to premillennialism. And I do. I've been challenging premillennialists on this program. We need to do a better job of proving premillennialism. Too much dumb stuff is being preached in the name of premillennialism. And I think the first thing we can do to help us do better in this area is approach all our eschatology with a more positive outlook. And because how we view these things, the attitude we view these things, is going to affect how we interpret certain things. And so make sure you watch my message this Sunday night. I'm going to be preaching on optimistic premillennialism. I'm going to make a very strong case. I'm going to attempt, let me say it that way, to make a very strong case for why we should view eschatology in a very positive way. I'm going to address the reasons people get it wrong. I get it. I've messed that up myself in the past. It's a pretty honest mistake, but it is wrong. And we will not help the premillennialists out by continuing in that error. Let's get this right. Let's do it right. Let's approach this right. And I do. I believe it will make a big difference. So again, I appreciate Pastor Wilson for having this discussion. He got me thinking about a lot of stuff. Those are the people I like. I was challenged. I'm okay with that. I'm okay with that. And I am still a premillennialist. And I don't believe it's just out of stubbornness. No, I'm still there, folks. And I think we can do better improving it. I hope we do better improving it. And you know what? And I hope it doesn't make me look weak when I say I don't hate amillennialists and postmillennialists, nor do I think they are heretics for those reasons. And we got to watch out for that. We're not helping our cause by being extreme on the accusations and the labeling. And so I appreciate everybody watching this. If you have any questions, comments about premillennialism or whatever, leave them. I'm hoping to do more things in the future, hopefully strengthening premillennialism, undoing all the damage the dispies have done to that subject. And I hope it will be a help and a blessing. Make sure you like, subscribe, comment, and help the algorithm. And we will appreciate that very much. So thank you all for watching this. God bless. Thank you.